The Social Side of Edison, abridged from Edison, His Life and Inventions by Frank Lewis Dyer and Thomas Comerford Martin. Edison never sought society, but society has never ceased to seek him. And today, as ever, the pressure upon him to give up his work and receive honors, meet distinguished people, or attend public functions is intense. Only 2 or 3 years ago, a flattering invitation came from one of the great English universities to receive a degree. But at that moment, he was deep in experiments on his new storage battery, and nothing could budge him. He would not drop the work, and while highly appreciative of the proposed honor, let it go by rather than quit for a week or two the stern drudgery of probing for the fact and the truth. Whether one approves or not, it is at least admirable stoicism, of which the world has too little. A similar instance is that of a visit paid to the laboratory by someone bringing a gold medal from a foreign society. It was a very hot day in summer. The visitor was in full social regalia of silk hat and frock coat, and insisted he could deliver the medal only into Edison's hands. At that moment, Edison, stripped pretty nearly down to the buff, was at the very crisis of an important experiment, and refused absolutely to be interrupted. He had neither sought nor expected the medal, and if the delegate didn't care to leave it, he could take it away. At last Edison was over-persuaded, and all dirty and perspiring as he was, received the medal rather than cause the visitor to come again. On one occasion, receiving a medal in New York, Edison forgot it on the ferry boat and left it behind. A few years ago, when Edison had received the Albert Medal of the Royal Society of Arts, one of the present authors called at the laboratory to see it. Nobody knew where it was. Hours passed before it could be found, and when at last the accompanying letter was produced, it had an office date stamped right over the signature of the royal president. A visitor to the laboratory with one of these medallic awards asked Edison if he had any others. "Oh, yes," he said. "I have a couple of quarts more up at the house." All this sounds like lack of appreciation, but it is anything else than that. While in Paris in 1889, he wore the decoration of the Legion of Honor whenever occasion required, but at all other times turned the badge under his lapel because he hated to have fellow Americans think he was showing off. And anyone who knew Edison will bear testimony to his utter absence of ostentation. It may be added that in addition to the 2 quarts of medals up at the house, there will be found at Glenmont many other signal tokens of esteem and goodwill. A beautiful cigar case from the late Tsar of Russia, bronzes from the government of Japan, steel trophies from Krupp, and a host of other mementos, to one of which he thus refers. When experiments with the light were going on at Menlo Park, Sarah Bernhardt came to America. One evening, Robert L. Cutting of New York brought her out to see the light. She was a terrific rubberneck. She jumped all over the machinery, and I had one man especially to guard her dress. She wanted to know everything. She would speak in French, and Cutting would translate into English. She stayed there about an hour and a half. Bernhardt gave me 2 pictures painted by herself, which she sent me from Paris. Reference has already been made to the callers upon Edison, and to give simply the names of persons of distinction would fill many pages of this record. Some were mere consumers of time, others were gladly welcomed, like Lord Kelvin, the greatest physicist of the last century, with whom Edison was always in friendly communication. The first time I saw Lord Kelvin, he came to my laboratory at Menlo Park in 1876. He reported most favorably on Edison's automatic telegraph system at the Philadelphia Exposition of 1876. I was then experimenting with sending 8 messages simultaneously over a wire by means of synchronizing tuning forks. I would take a wire with similar apparatus at both ends and would throw it over on one set of instruments, take it away and get it back so quickly that you could not miss it, thereby taking advantage of the rapidity of electricity to perform operations. On my local wire, I got it to work very nicely. When Sir William Thomson, that is to say Kelvin, came in the room, he was introduced to me and had a number of friends with him. He said, "What have you here?" I told him briefly what it was. He then turned around and, to my great surprise, explained the whole thing to his friends. Quite a different exhibition was given 2 weeks later by another well-known Englishman, also an electrician, who came in with his friends, and I was trying for 2 hours to explain it to him and failed. After the introduction of the electric light, Edison was more than ever in demand socially, but he shunned functions like the plague, not only because of the serious interference with work, but because of his deafness. Some dinners he had to attend, but a man who ate little and heard less could derive practically no pleasure from them. George Washington Childs was very anxious I should go down to Philadelphia to dine with him. I seldom went to dinners. He insisted I should go, that a special car would leave New York. It was for me to meet Mr. Joseph Chamberlain. We had the private car of Mr. Roberts, president of the Pennsylvania Railroad. We had one of those celebrated dinners that only Mr. Childs could give, and I heard speeches from Charles Francis Adams and different people. When I came back to the depot, Mr. Roberts was there and insisted on carrying my satchel for me. I could never understand that. Among the more distinguished visitors of the electric lighting period was President Diaz, with whom Edison became quite intimate. President Diaz of Mexico visited this country with Mrs. Diaz, a highly educated and beautiful woman. She spoke very good English. They both took a deep interest in all they saw. I don't know how it ever came about, as it is not in my line, but I seemed to be delegated to show them around. I took them to the railroad buildings, electric light plants, fire departments, and showed them a great variety of things. It lasted 2 days. Of another visit, Edison says, Sitting Bull and 15 Sioux Indians came to Washington to see the great father, and then to New York, and went to the Girk Street Works. We could make some very good pyrotechnics there, so we determined to give the Indians a scare, but it didn't work. We had an arc there of a most terrifying character, but they never moved a muscle. Another episode at Girk Street did not find the visitors quite so stoical. In testing dynamos at Girk Street, we had a long flat belt running parallel with the floor about 4 inches above it, and traveling 4,000 feet a minute. One day one of the directors brought in 3 or 4 ladies to the works to see the electric light system. One of the ladies had a little poodle led by a string. The belt was running so smoothly and evenly, the poodle did not notice the difference between it and the floor, and got into the belt before we could do anything. The dog was whirled around 40 or 50 times, and a little flat piece of leather came out, and the ladies fainted. A very interesting period on the social side was a visit paid by Edison and his family to Europe in 1889, when he had made a splendid exhibit of his inventions and apparatus at the great Paris Centennial Exposition of that year, to the extreme delight of the French, who welcomed him with open arms. The political sentiments that the exposition celebrated were not such as to find general sympathy in monarchical Europe, so that the crowned heads were conspicuous by their absence. It was not, of course, by way of theatrical antithesis that Edison appeared in Paris at such a time, but the contrast was nonetheless striking and effective. It was felt that, after all, that which the great exposition exemplified at its best, the triumph of genius over matter, over ignorance, over superstition, met with its due recognition when Edison came to participate and to felicitate a noble nation that could show so much in the victories of civilization and the arts, despite its long trials and its long struggle for liberty. It is no exaggeration to say that Edison was greeted with the enthusiastic homage of the whole French people. They could find no praise warm enough for the man who had organized the echoes and tamed the lightning, and whose career was so picturesque with eventful and romantic development. In fact, for weeks together it seemed as though no Parisian paper was considered complete and up to date without an article on Edison. At the close of the exposition, Edison was created a commander of the Legion of Honor. His own exhibit made it a personal expense of over $100,000, covered several thousand square feet in the vast machinery hall, and was centered around a huge Edison lamp built of myriads of small lamps of the ordinary size. The great attraction, however, was the display of the perfected phonograph. Several instruments were provided, and every day, all day long, while the exposition lasted, queues of eager visitors from every quarter of the globe were waiting to hear the little machine talk and sing and reproduce their own voices. Never before was such a collection of the languages of the world made. It was the first linguistic concourse since Babel times. We must let Edison tell the story of some of his experiences. At the Universal Exposition at Paris in 1889, I made a personal exhibit covering about an acre. As I had no intention of offering to sell anything, I was showing and pushing no companies. The whole exhibition was made for honor and without any hope of profit. But the Paris newspapers came around and wanted pay for notices of it, which we promptly refused. Whereupon there was rather a stormy time for a while, but nothing was published about it. While at the exposition, I visited the Opera House. The President of France lent me his private box. The Opera House was one of the first to be lighted by the incandescent lamp, and the manager took great pleasure in showing me down through the labyrinth containing the wiring, dynamos, etc. When I came into the box, the orchestra played the Star-Spangled Banner, and all the people in the house arose, whereupon I was very much embarrassed. After I had been an hour at the play, the manager came around and asked me to go underneath the stage, as they were putting on a ballet of 300 girls, the finest ballet in Europe. It seemed there is a little hole on the stage with a hood over it in which the prompter sits when opera is given. In this instance it was not occupied, and I was given the position in the prompter's seat and saw the whole ballet at close range. The city of Paris gave me a dinner at the Hotel de Ville, which was also lighted with the Edison system. They had a very fine installation of machinery. As I could not understand or speak a word of French, I went to see our minister, Mr. Whitelaw Reed, and got him to send a deputy to answer for me, which he did with my grateful thanks. Then the telephone company gave me a dinner and the engineers of France, and I attended the dinner celebrating the 50th anniversary of the discovery of photography. Then they sent to Reed my decoration, and they tried to put a sash on me, but I could not stand for it. My wife had me wear the little red button, but when I saw Americans coming, I would slip it out of my lapel, as I thought they would jolly me for wearing it. Nor was this all. Edison naturally met many of the celebrities of France. I visited the Eiffel Tower at the invitation of Eiffel. We went to the top, where there was an extension and a small place in which was Eiffel's private office. In this was a piano. When my wife and I arrived at the top, we found that Gounod, the composer, was there. We stayed a couple of hours, and Gounod sang and played for us. We spent a day at Meudon, an old palace given by the government to Janssen, the astronomer. He occupied three rooms, and there were 300. He had the grand dining room for his laboratory. He showed me a gyroscope he had got up, which made the incredible number of 4,000 revolutions in a second. A modification of this was afterward used on the French Atlantic lines for making an artificial horizon to take observations for position at sea. In connection with this, a gentleman came to me a number of years afterward, and I got out a part of some plans for him. He wanted to make a gigantic gyroscope weighing several tons to be run by an electric motor and put on a sailing ship. He wanted this gyroscope to keep a platform perfectly horizontal no matter how rough the sea was. Upon this platform he was going to mount a telescope to observe an eclipse off the Gold Coast of Africa, but for some reason it was never completed. Pasteur invited me to come down to the Institute, and I went and had quite a chat with him. I saw a large number of persons being inoculated, and also the whole modus operandi, which was very interesting. I saw one beautiful boy about 10, the son of an English lord. His father was with him. He had been bitten in the face and was taking the treatment. I said to Pasteur, "Will he live?" "No," said he. "The boy will be dead in 6 days. He was bitten too near the top of the spinal column and came too late." Edison has no opinion to offer as an expert on art, but he has his own standard of taste. Of course, I visited the Louvre and saw the old masters, which I could not enjoy, and I attended the Luxembourg with modern masters, which I enjoyed greatly. To my mind, the old masters are not art, and I suspect that many others are of the same opinion, and that their value is their scarcity, and in the variety of men with lots of money. Something akin to this is a shrewd comment on one feature of the exposition. I spent several days in the exposition at Paris. I remember going to the exhibit of the Kimberley Diamond Mines, and they kindly permitted me to take diamonds from some of the blue earth which they were washing by machinery to exhibit the mine operations. I found several beautiful diamonds, but they seemed a little lightweight to me when I was picking them out. They were diamonds for exhibition purposes, probably glass. This did not altogether complete the European trip of 1889, for Edison wished to see Helmholtz. After leaving Paris, we went to Berlin. The French papers then came out and attacked me because I went to Germany and said I was now going over to the enemy. I visited all the things of interest in Berlin, and then on my way home I went with Helmholtz and Siemens in a private compartment to the meeting of the German Association of Science at Heidelberg and spent 2 days there. When I started from Berlin on the trip, I began to tell American stories. Siemens was very fond of these stories and would laugh immensely at them and could see the points and the humor by his imagination. But Helmholtz could not see one of them. Siemens would quickly in German explain the point, but Helmholtz could not see it, although he understood English, which Siemens could speak. Still, the explanations were made in German. I always wished I could have understood Siemens' explanations of the points of those stories. When I crossed over to England, I heard a good deal about the terrors of the English Channel as regards seasickness. I'd been over the ocean 3 times and did not know what seasickness was, so far as I was concerned myself. I was told that while a man might not get seasick on the ocean, if he met a good storm in the Channel, it would do for him. When we arrived at Calais to cross over, everybody made for the restaurant. I did not care about eating and did not go to the restaurant, but my family did. I walked out and tried to find the boat. Going along the dock, I saw 2 small smokestacks sticking up, and looking down, saw a little boat. "Where is the steamer that goes across the channel?" "This is the boat." There had been a storm in the North Sea that had carried away some of the boats on the German steamer, and it certainly looked awful tough outside. I said to the man, "Will that boat live in that sea?" "Oh, yes," he said, "but we've had a bad storm." So I made up my mind that perhaps I would get sick this time. The managing director of the English railroad owning the line was Forbes, who heard I was coming over and placed the private salon at my disposal. The moment my family got in the room with the French lady's maid and the rest, they commenced to get sick. So I felt pretty sure I was in for it. We started out of the little inlet and got into the channel, and that boat went into 17 directions simultaneously. I waited a while to see what was going to occur, and then went into the smoking compartment. Nobody was there. By and by the fun began. Sounds of all kinds and varieties were heard in every direction. They were all sick. There must have been 100 people aboard. I didn't see a single exception except the waiters and myself. I asked one of the waiters concerning the boat itself, and was taken to see the engineer and went down to look at the engines and saw the captain. But I kept mostly in the smoking room. I was smoking a big cigar, and when a man looked in I would give a big puff, and every time they saw that they would go away and begin again. The English Channel is a holy terror, all right, but it didn't affect me. I must be out of balance. While at the Foot's Cray, I met one of the backers of Ferranti, then putting up a gigantic alternating current dynamo near London to send 10 or 15,000 volts up into the main district of the city for electrical lighting. I think Pender was interested. At any rate, the people invited to dinner were very much interested, and they questioned me as to what I thought of the proposition. I said I hadn't any thought about it, and could not give any opinion until I saw it. So I was taken up to London to see the dynamo in course of construction and the methods employed, and they insisted I should give them some expression of my views. While I gave them my opinion, it was reluctantly. I did not want to do so. I thought that commercially the thing was too ambitious, that Ferranti's ideas were too big just then, that he ought to have started a little smaller until he was sure. I understand that this installation was not commercially successful, as there were a great many troubles. But Ferranti had good ideas, and he was no small man. Incidentally, it may be noted here that during the same year, 1889, the various manufacturing Edison lighting interests in America were brought together under the leadership of Mr. Henry Villard and consolidated in the Edison General Electric Company, with a capital of no less than $12 million on an 8% dividend basis. The numerous Edison central stations all over the country represented much more than that sum, and made a splendid outlet for the product of the factories. A few years later came the consolidation with the Thomas Houston interest in the General Electric Company, which under the brilliant and vigorous management of President C.A. Coffin has become one of the greatest manufacturing institutions of the country, with an output of apparatus reaching upwards of $75 million annually. It might appear strange on the surface, but one of the reasons that most influenced Edison to regrets in connection with the big trade of 1889 was that it separated him from his old friend and ally Bergman, who on selling out saw a great future for himself in Germany, went there and realized it. Edison has always had an amused admiration for Bergman, and his social side is often made evident by his love of telling stories about those days of struggle. Some of the stories were told for this volume. "Bergman came to work for me as a boy," says Edison. "He started in on stock quotation printers. As he was a rapid workman and paid no attention to the clock, I took a fancy to him and gave him piecework. He contrived so many little tools to cheapen the work that he made lots of money. I even helped him get up tools, until it occurred to me that this was too rapid a process of getting rid of my money, as I hadn't the heart to cut the price when it was originally fair. After a year or so, Bergman got enough money to start a small shop in Worcester Street, New York, and it was at this shop that the first phonographs were made for sale. Then came the carbon telephone transmitter, a large number of which were made by Bergman for the Western Union. Finally came the electric light. A dynamo was installed in Bergman's shop to permit him to test the various small devices which he was then making for the system. The conversation with Edison that elicited these stories brought out some details as to peril that attends experimentation. He has confronted many a serious physical risk and counts himself lucky to have come through without a scratch or scar. Four instances of personal danger may be noted in his own language. When I started at Menlo, I had an electric furnace for welding rare metals that I did not know about very clearly. It was in the dark room where I had a lot of chloride of sulfur, a very corrosive liquid. I did not know that it would decompose by water. I poured in a beaker full of water, and the whole thing exploded and threw a lot of it into my eyes. I ran to the hydrant, leaned over backward, opened my eyes, and ran the hydrant water right into them. But it was 2 weeks before I could see. The next time we just saved ourselves. I was making some stuff to squirt into filaments for the incandescent lamp. I made about a pound of it. I had used ammonia and bromine. I did not know it at the time, but I had made bromide of nitrogen. I put the large bulk of it in three filters, and after it had been washed and all the water had come through the filter, I opened the three filters and laid them on a hot steam plate to dry with the stuff. While I and Mr. Sadler, one of my assistants, were working near it, there was a sudden flash of light and a very smart explosion. I said to Sadler, "What's that?" "I don't know," he said, and we paid no attention. In about half a minute there was a sharp concussion, and Sadler said, "See, it is that stuff on the steam plate." I grabbed the whole thing and threw it in the sink and poured water on it. I saved a little of it and found it was a terrific explosive. The reason why those preliminary explosions took place was that a little had spattered out on the edge of the filter paper, and it dried first and exploded. Had the main body exploded, there would have been nothing left of the laboratory I was working in. At another time, I had a briquetting machine for briquetting iron ore. I had a lever held down by a powerful spring, and a rod 1 inch in diameter and 4 feet long. While I was experimenting with it and standing beside it, a washer broke, and that spring threw the rod right up to the ceiling with a blast, and it came down again just within an inch of my nose and went clear through a 2-inch plank. That was within an inch of your life, as they say. In the experimental plant for concentrating iron ore in the northern part of New Jersey, we had a vertical dryer, a column about 9 feet square and 80 feet high. At the bottom there was a space where two men could go through a hole, and then all the rest of the column was filled with baffle plates. One day this dryer got blocked and the ore would not run down. So I and the vice president of the company, Mr. Mallory, crowded through the manhole to see why the ore would not come down. After we got in, the ore did come down, and there were 14 tons of it above us. The men outside knew we were in there, and they had a great time digging us out and getting air to us. Such incidents brought out in narration the fact that many of the men working with him had been less fortunate, particularly those who had experimented with the Rontgen X-ray, whose ravages, like those of leprosy, were responsible for the mutilation and death of at least one expert assistant. In the early days of work on the incandescent lamp also, there was a considerable trouble with mercury. I had a series of vacuum pumps worked by mercury and used for exhausting experimental incandescent lamps. The main pipe, which was full of mercury, was about 7 1/2 feet from the floor. Along the length of the pipe were outlets to which thick rubber tubing was connected, each tube to a pump. One day, while experimenting with the mercury pump, my assistant, an awkward country lad from a farm on Staten Island, who had adenoids in his nose and breathed through his mouth, which was always open wide, was looking up at this pipe at a small leak of mercury. when the rubber tube came off and probably 2 pounds of mercury went into his mouth and down his throat and got through his system somehow. In a short time he became salivated and his teeth got loose. He went home, and shortly his mother appeared at the laboratory with a horsewhip which she proposed to use on the proprietor. I was fortunately absent, and she was mollified somehow by my other assistants. I had given the boy considerable iodine of potassium to prevent salivation, but it was no good in this case. When the first lamp works were started at Menlo Park, one of my experiments seemed to show that hot mercury gave a better vacuum in the lamp than cold mercury. I thereupon started to heat it. Soon all the men got salivated and things looked serious, but I found that in the mirror factories where mercury was used extensively, the French government made the giving of iodine of potassium compulsory to prevent salivation. I carried out this idea and made every man take a dose every day, but there was great opposition, and hot mercury was finally abandoned. It will have been gathered that Edison has owed his special immunity from occupational diseases not only to luck but to unusual powers of endurance and a strong physique inherited no doubt from his father. Mr. Mallory mentions a little fact that bears on this exceptional quality of bodily powers. I have often been surprised at Edison's wonderful capacity for the instant visual perception of differences in materials that were invisible to others until he would patiently point them out. This had puzzled me for years, but one day I was unexpectedly led into part of the secret. For some little time past, Mr. Edison had noticed that he was bothered somewhat in reading print, and I asked him to have an oculist give him reading glasses. Partially promised, but never took time to attend to it. One day he and I were in the city, and as Mrs. Edison had spoken to me about it, and as we happened to have an hour to spare, I persuaded him to go to an oculist with me. Using no names, I asked the latter to examine the gentleman's eyes. He did so very conscientiously, and it was an interesting experience, for he was kept busy answering Mr. Edison's numerous questions. When the oculist finished, he turned to me and said, "I have been many years in the business, but have never seen an optic nerve like that of this gentleman. An ordinary optic nerve is about the thickness of a thread, but his is like a cord. He must be a remarkable man in some walk of life. It has certainly required great bodily vigor and physical capacity to sustain such fatigue as Edison has all his life imposed upon himself, to the extent on one occasion of going 5 days without sleep. In a conversation during 1909, he remarked, as though it were nothing out of the way, that up to 7 years previously his average of daily working hours was 19 1/2. But that since then he has figured it at 18. He said he stood it easily because he was interested in everything and was reading and studying all the time. For instance, he had gone to bed the night before exactly at 12 and had arisen at 4:30 a.m. to read some New York law reports. It was suggested that the secret of it might be that he did not live in the past but was always looking forward to a greater future, to which he replied, "Yes, that's it. I don't live with the past. I am living for today and tomorrow. I am interested in every department of science, arts, and manufacture. I read all the time on astronomy, chemistry, biology, physics, music, metaphysics, mechanics, and other branches, political economy, electricity, and, in fact, all things that are making for progress in the world. I get all the proceedings of the scientific societies, the principal scientific and trade journals, and I read them. I also read the Clipper, the Police Gazette, the Billboard, the Dramatic Mirror, and a lot of similar publications, for I like to know what is going on. In this way I keep up to date, and I live in a great moving world of my own, and what's more, I enjoy every minute of it." Referring to some event of the past, he said, "Spilt milk doesn't interest me. I have spilt lots of it, and while I have always felt it for a few days, it is quickly forgotten, and I turn again to the future. During another talk on kindred affairs, it was suggested to Edison that as he'd worked so hard all his life, it was about time to think somewhat of the pleasures of travel and the social side of life. To which he replied laughingly, "I already have a schedule worked out. From now until I am 75 years of age, I expect to keep more or less busy with my regular work, not, however, working as many hours or as hard as I have in the past. At 75, I expect to wear loud waistcoats with fancy buttons, also gaiter tops. At 80, I expect to learn how to play bridge, whist, and talk foolishly to the ladies. At 85, I expect to wear a full dress suit every evening at dinner, and at 90, well, I never plan more than 30 years ahead." The reference to clothes is interesting, as it is one of the few subjects in which Edison has no interest. It rather bores him. His dress is always of the plainest, in fact so plain that at the Bergman shops in New York, the children attending a parochial Catholic school were wont to salute him with the finger to the head every time he went by. Upon inquiring, he found that they took him for a priest, with his dark garb, smooth-shaven face, and serious expression. Edison says, "I get a suit that fits me, then I compel the tailors to use that as a jig or pattern or blueprint to make others buy." For many years, a suit was used as a measurement. Once or twice they took fresh measurements, but those didn't fit and they had to go back. "I eat to keep my weight constant, hence I never change measurements." In regard to this, Mr. Mallory furnished a bit of chat as follows. "In a lawsuit in which I was a witness, I went out to lunch with the lawyers on both sides, and the lawyer who had been cross-examining me stated that he had for a client a Fifth Avenue tailor who had told him that he made all of Mr. Edison's clothes for the last 20 years and that he had never seen him. He said that some 20 years ago a suit was sent to him from Orange and measurements were made from it, and that every suit since then has been made from these measurements. I may add from my own personal observation that in Mr. Edison's clothes there is no evidence but that every new suit that he has worn in that time looks as if he had been specially measured for it, which shows how very little he has changed physically in the last 20 years. Edison has never had any taste for amusements, although he will indulge in the game of parcheesi and has a billiard table in his house. The coming of the automobile was a great boon to him because it gave him a form of outdoor sport in which he could indulge in a spirit of observation without the guilty feeling that he was wasting valuable time. In his automobile, he's made long tours and with his family has particularly indulged his taste for botany. It might be expected that Edison would have extreme and even radical ideas on the subject of education, and he has, as well as a perfect readiness to express them, because he considers that time is wasted on things that are not essential. "What we need," he has said, "are men capable of doing work. I wouldn't give a penny for the ordinary college graduate, except those from institutes of technology. Those coming up from the ranks are a darn sight better than the others. They aren't filled up with Latin philosophy and the rest of that ninny stuff." A further remark of his is, "What the country needs now is the practical, skilled engineer who is capable of doing everything. In 3 or 4 centuries, when the country is settled and commercialism is diminished, there will be time for the literary men. At present we want engineers, industrial men, good business-like managers, and railroad men." It is hardly to be marveled at that such views should elicit warm protest, summed up in the comment, "Mr. Edison and many like him see in reverse the course of human progress. Invention does not smooth the way for the practical men and make them possible. There is always too much danger of neglecting thoughts for things, ideas for machinery. No theory of education that aggravates this danger is consistent with natural well-being." Edison is slow to discuss the great mysteries of life, but is of reverential attitude of mind and ever tolerant of others' beliefs. He is not a religious man in the sense of turning to forms and creeds, but, as might be expected, is inclined as an inventor and creator to argue from the basis of design and thence to infer a designer. After years of watching the processes of nature, he says, I can no more doubt the existence of an intelligence that is running things than I do of the existence of myself. Take, for example, the substance water that forms the crystals known as ice. Now, there are hundreds of combinations that form crystals, and every one of them, save ice, sinks in water. Ice, I say, doesn't, and it is rather lucky for us mortals, for if it had done so, we would all be dead. Why? Simply because if ice sank to the bottom of rivers, lakes, and oceans as fast as it froze, those places would be frozen up and there would be no waters left. That is only one example out of thousands that to me prove beyond the possibility of a doubt that some vast intelligence is governing this and other planets. A few words as to the domestic and personal side of Edison's life, to which many incidental references have already been made in these pages. He was married in 1873 to Miss Mary Stillwell, who died in 1884, leaving three children, Thomas Alva, William Leslie, and Marion Estelle. Mr. Edison was married again in 1886 to Miss Mina Miller, daughter of Mr. Lewis Miller, a distinguished pioneer inventor and manufacturer in the field of agricultural machinery, and equally entitled to fame as the father of the Chautauqua idea and the founder with Bishop Vincent of the original Chautauqua, which now has so many replicas all over the country, and which started in motion one of the great modern educational and moral forces in America. By this marriage there are three children, Charles, Madeline, and Theodore. For over a score of years, dating from his marriage to Miss Miller, Edison's happy and perfect domestic life has been spent at Glenmont, a beautiful property acquired at that time in Llewellyn Park on the higher slopes of Orange Mountain, New Jersey, with an easy walking distance of the laboratory at the foot of the hill in West Orange. As noted already, the latter part of each winter is spent at Fort Myers, Florida, where Edison has, on the banks of the Chattahoochee River, a plantation home that is in many ways a miniature copy of the home and laboratory up north. Glenmont is a rather elaborate and florid building in Queen Anne English style, of brick, stone, and wooden beams showing on the exterior, with an abundance of gables and balconies. It is set in an environment of woods and sweeps of lawn, flanked by unusually large conservatories and always bright in summer with glowing flower beds. It would be difficult to imagine Edison in a stiffly formal house, and this big, cozy, three-story rambling mansion has an easy freedom about it, without and within, quite in keeping with the genius of the inventor, but revealing at every turn traces of feminine taste and culture. A large cabinet contains awards, decorations, and medals presented to Edison accumulated in the course of a long career. Nearby may be noticed a bronze replica of the Edison Gold Medal, which was founded in the American Institute of Electrical Engineers, the first award of which was made to Elihu Thompson during the present year, 1910. There are statues of serpentine marble, gifts of the late Tsar of Russia, whose admiration is also represented by a gorgeous inlaid and enameled cigar case. There are typical bronze vases from the Society of Engineers of Japan and a striking desk set of writing apparatus from Krupp, all the pieces being made out of tiny but massive guns and shells of Krupp steel. In addition to such bric-a-brac and bibelots of all kinds are many pictures and photographs, including the original sketches of the reception given to Edison in 1889 by the Paris Figueroa, and a letter from Madame Carnot placing the presidential opera box at the disposal of Mr. and Mrs. Edison. One of the most conspicuous features of the room is a phonograph equipment on which the latest and best productions of the greatest singers and musicians can always be heard, but which Edison himself is everlastingly experimenting with, under the incurable delusion that this domestic retreat is but an extension of his laboratory. And that is the conclusion of Edison, his life and inventions. These chapters have been abridged from the text, which may be found at www.gutenberg.org, Edison, His Life and Inventions.